There's a lot of loose talk in this town. Everybody you see, well, they're talking about me and the story that's going around.
Welcome to Americana with John McEwen. Today he's interviewing Pat Mason.
Well, this is John McEwen, and I have the extreme pleasure of talking to Pat Mason, N-A-S-O-N. And Pat, you've been a writer for UPI for, well, how long?
June's going to be 20 years.
Wow. Now, in that writing, you write about music and actors. You interview hundreds of people over the years, I bet, like Blues Traveler, Mickey Dolenz, Quentin Tarantino, and a few others.
Oh, sure, yeah. In fact, for about 5 or 6 years, I specialized in writing about entertainment. Of course, for a large part of the time, I was working in Los Angeles as a general assignment reporter, but it's such a company town that you're a de facto entertainment reporter anyway. So, yeah, I interviewed lots and lots of people.
Well, for those that don't know, what is UPI and what do they do?
It's United Press International. It's a news service. It's always been privately held. And it initially began about 100 years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
And, yeah. At one point, it was called UP, United Press. I joined the company in 1991 with the radio network. We had a radio network in those days where we provided hourly newscasts and then hourly closed-circuit feeds for local stations to have sound bites that they could cut into their own programming. And I started work as an editor at the radio network there, and came to L.A. about a year later.
So your stuff that you've talked to people over the years has gone out nationally, worldwide, and people learn about music that they either have heard about or don't know they've heard about through your writing. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. In fact, that's one of my favorite parts of the job has always been to discover something, to find something that's relatively new or fresh and get it out there and give people an opportunity to know about it. And one of the reasons why I like that so much is because I can remember when I was 20, 18, 19, 20 years old, that's how I found out about a lot of really cool stuff, was reading about it in the media.
Mm-hmm. What about, when did you cross paths with Duran Duran? Was it at the beginning of their, in the middle? What part?
It was, I'm going to say mid to late 90s. This might have been their first reunion, first sort of comeback deal. And it was really fun. It was nice to, I met the four of them down in Santa Monica and had a nice conversation about their music. And by the way, that's another nice thing about this type of work is that you, not only do you get to share what you learn with other people. To me, I learned an awful lot. I was introduced to a lot of stuff I hadn't been familiar with. For example, when Duran Duran was around in the 80s and they were like all over MTV and so forth,
mm-hmm.
I didn't know so much about them. I mean, I liked their music okay, but I wasn't. But when you are going to interview somebody, one of the things you want to do is to, you know, do your research, do your due diligence, and then you find out some things about the music that you didn't know, and you go, oh, actually, I kind of like that, you know, and maybe add it to your collection.
It must have been interesting interviewing Mickey Dolenz. At what point in time, I met Mickey Dolenz when he was waiting for the Monkees to start up, and he was, 21 years old, just turning 21, waiting to collect his circus boy money. Peter Tork was working in the kitchen at the Golden Bear, where the dirt band was playing, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band was playing at this club in Orange County. And Peter's in the kitchen. The dishwasher had a little line of girls at the back door waiting to get his autograph, and we couldn't figure out, why are people getting the autograph of the dishwasher? Well, he'd been in the teen magazines, this coming group and stuff. And Mickey had come down a couple nights so they could talk about their future. I'm just curious. The Monkees made a huge impression. They were ridiculed, and then they were emulated, and then they were mocked, and then they were appreciated. And when did you interview Mickey Dolenz, and how did he feel about his past?
Well, first of all, what you're describing with Peter Tork is exactly what I'm talking about. See, nobody knew who he was except they found out because they read Teen Magazine. And this goes to show you the potency of, you know, that media coverage can have. And Mickey, I met Mickey probably the first year I was in L.A., so it had to be late 92, early 93, and he had a book. One of the coolest things about this job is that you just don't know when the phone's going to ring and somebody's going to say, hey, would you like to interview George Burns?
Did you?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know,
wow,
who doesn't? Who wouldn't want to hear? Well, so the publicist called, said, do you want to talk to Mickey Dolenz? And I said, sure. So they fixed it up for him to come downtown. Our studio was downtown at the time, in downtown L.A. And so he came over. It was just as nice as you can imagine. And real eager, just like he is in the show, in The Monkees. Just, you know, mm-hmm. eager to please and everything. Just, and, you know, John, one more thing I want to say. One of the things that makes this job a real blast, or did anyway when I was still doing it regularly, is that the people that you interview, the people that you meet, are almost by definition interesting people.
Huh.
You know, there's a reason why people get to be stars, why people get to be high profile. To me, they're not interesting because they're high profile. It's much more likely that they're high profile because they're interesting.
Hmm. That's something that if they understood what made that happen, it might work better for them. I do know this, that the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, from the time we started in 1966, we had a career because of press, not necessarily radio, because there was a lot of fallow years. And the press that was cooperative every now and then we'd get a review. Well, that was Billboard. Our first review in Billboard in a 1967 show said, doubtful if they'll ever be captured on record. Well, that was the one that wasn't helpful. But I have that on my wall next to the platinum album for the Circle album in the same frame. So, ha ha. But thank you, Pat, for all the years of writing when you maybe didn't need to, and for writing about Mickey Dolenz's book and everything. So what's it like when you come across someone like Quentin Tarantino? I mean, like, does he need press?
I have to be honest. I was stunned that I was offered an interview with him. Because at the time, it was shortly after Pulp Fiction. He was promoting, a video release on Jackie Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, when somebody offered me, it was a phone interview, and I thought I was being punked. I wondered whether somebody's going to, you know. But it was Quentin Tarantino, and it was a real
interview.
You mean
you thought it wasn't going to be Quentin Tarantino?
Especially because he's a real generous interview. You know, you don't have to pull stuff out of him.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's what it's like talking to him. He's almost, we mentioned George Burns a little while ago, you know, how he would come on stage with Gracie Allen, and he'd say, Gracie, how's your mother? And then she'd do the rest of the act. So it was like that with Quentin Tarantino. One time I interviewed the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi on the phone.
Oh, my gosh.
I pitched, do you want to talk to Maharishi? I said, sure, yeah. Well, you only have 5 minutes. He's going to be at the airport. So he'll come on the phone, and you just have 5 minutes. I can't stress enough. I said, okay, fine. And it was a real bang-bang setup. I didn't have time to research or formulate decent questions or anything. It turns out it just didn't matter because they put him on the phone. I said, Maharishi, good morning, how are you? And he never stopped. he didn't come up for air one single time.
How long was it?
About 5 minutes.
Oh.
But he also, I have to say, he said nothing intelligible. I went back to listen to the tape to cut it up, and I thought, this is entirely unusable. I got nothing out of it.
So what about Robert Duvall? Is that a different situation?
Also a phoner, and he was promoting. This happened around the time he was up for an Oscar for The Apostle, which he won, I think. Pretty sure he won Best Actor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe he won for Tender Mercies. Anyway, he was up for an Oscar for a brilliant movie. He's just brilliant in it. And, you know, got about 10 minutes on the phone with him, and right around Oscar time, that's when you started to get your high-profile bites, you know, because once the nominations come out, the publicists are trying to get their people all over the place. They'll book them everywhere they can possibly get them. So, you know, you wind up getting phoners with, you know, they wouldn't find time in their schedule for everybody who wanted a piece of them. It's just impossible.
You know, it's always been a funny thing to me when you see publicity on people and you hear about somebody that did something. One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you was to let people that listen to this know how strange that world is. It's not that Lindsay Lohan is eating lunch and there's a bunch of people taking pictures of her. It's more like she's going to go to lunch and her publicist puts out the word that she's going to go to Spago at noon so they can go collect there and get some pictures. Or that even from Blues Traveler to James Horner, I know people you've all talked to, they have something they need to tell people, and you're people such as yourself are the conduit for that. And
without question.
Without question, you say.
Without question, I would say it even gets a little slightly more complicated than that. It has a layer most people don't recognize. For example, you mentioned, say Lindsay Lohan as an example, going to go eat a Spago. If you're a savvy publicist, you don't just blatantly call the media and say, "Oh, Lindsay's going to be at Spago having lunch."
Well,
and by the way, here's another little trick too. Everybody who reads Parade magazine in the Sunday papers.
Yep, that's about 7 million or 17 million people or something.
Yeah, and then on the inside of the front cover, they always have that Q&A. It used to be Roger Scott. Who's doing it now? I'm telling you now. You know, you read it and there's always a question in there that says, "I was always a big fan of Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet. Whatever happened to them?" And the answer is, "Well, they just happened to be starting a new engagement at Las Vegas this week." And I don't know this for a fact, John, but I'll bet you real money that stuff is planted.
From my side, I know it for a fact because there's been times when I've said to a publicist, "Get us in the Parade Q&A." You know, it's not like somebody really wants to know, but they'll go dig through their files and find somebody that might have asked a related question to help fill that space. You know, one thing I learned years ago, Pat, again, this is John McEwen speaking with Pat Nason on syndicatednews.net, and I'm very glad that you could be here because I'm on the other side of the fence with a man that's been asking me questions for 20 years. And one of the things I learned early on, Pat, with like 1969 or so, when I thought we were getting a lot of press and we were important, I had a PR person at a record company say, "Look, don't let it go to your head. It's called fluff. All this music business news is called fluff by most people because the news people get inundated with piles of fluff. And when they have a page, they're very likely to say, 'Hey, Bob, I've got a quarter column page space I need to fill. Well, go look in the fluff box. I think there's something in there.' Or go find some fluff to stick in there." That's when you become some quote unquote newsworthy because you can fill up a blank space on a page. Does that sound familiar?
It does sound familiar. And I'll tell you, here's another wrinkle. but pretty quickly, it occurred to me not to be too cynical, you know?
Thank you. Listen, thanks for taking the time for doing an interview with me so I can tell people about the new album. Blah, blah, blah. I really appreciate you. I can hear it now, you know. And then they hang up and they go, "Next." But no, Pat, let me tell you, you have a good reputation out there. I know other people that have interviewed with you and talked to you. And people on my side, jumping back over the fence, always appreciate it when there's someone to talk to and that might be interested. Because especially someone like James Horner or Al Silvestri, because you've interviewed movie scoring people that don't normally get press. And these guys have, I mean, James Horner, what has he done? Everything that many people have seen.
Oh, he's done Titanic, Glory. Geez, I can't even begin to tell you. But you know what? You bring up a point as an interviewer. I mean, I hear the complaints, whether it's artists or musicians or ball players or politicians. I hear them talking about the relative inanity of a lot of questions that they get. And I agree. I think they completely have a point. So I just always made it a point when I'm getting ready to interview somebody to do some research, which some of the interviewers just don't do, and to make it a point to ask interesting, engaging questions. There are some questions that everybody asks that they're more or less obligatory. You have to ask them, but that doesn't mean you have to spend the whole 20 minutes asking the same damn questions over and over again that everybody asks them all the time. And
yeah.
I think it's out of respect for the interview subject, not only the person, but the subject matter. And one more thing, you're right. Talking to music composers, I always been at a point when I could to talk to writers and to some degree producers. And the reason why is because actors, you know, they're fine, they're interesting, some of them are fascinating, but the writers, musicians, screenwriters, they're the ones that have ideas in their head. To me, they're much more fit subject for, you know, for conversations because they're
yeah.
the ones that actually think stuff through.
And they're the ones that gave the actors the job that made them famous.
Precisely. And producers. They know why they made the picture. They made, you know. So, yeah, that's I always found them to be very, very interesting to talk to. And hope, and I don't know, but I always kept my fingers crossed that listeners found them interesting to listen to.
I'm curious about your interview with John Popper of Blues Traveler. When did you do that?
That had to be around mid-90s or so.
So you've talked to a lot of people. You've talked to a lot of people as they were active and stuff. Do you have an impression from all the music people you've talked to at various levels about what's happening with the music business today? Is it in a good state or a difficult state? Do you have an overview of all this chatter about, oh, the record companies are closing, and when they really aren't, they're just shifting. Do you have a comment about the music business in general now? Because it's changed for sure.
Well, one of the things that I've observed is that the music business has been changing since day one. The music business has always been changing. The music business,
that's right.
Particularly the recorded music business, I should say.
Well, yeah, when Edison put out the cylinder. Edison put out the cylinder in 1895, and Columbia put out a different size cylinder a year later. And then a few years later, somebody put out a flat record with a song on the side. And then a few years later, they put a song on both sides. It was going 78, then the 33, then the 45, then the – yeah, it's always been in a state of flux. Mono to stereo to 8-track to cassette. So go ahead. Let me not interrupt.
It's my observation that what's happening to the music business right now, analogous to what's happening to the climate. It isn't that it changes, Newt. It's been changing forever, but the rate of change is accelerating so much that it's almost impossible to adapt. It's almost impossible because just as soon as you come up with a business model that seems to work, it's outdated 20 minutes later anyway.
I have an opinion about the music business that is not necessarily one that other artists like to hear. And I say that one of the problems with the fact it's hard to get airplay or new bands is that the content isn't as good as it used to be. And, you know, there's people that get known for making a certain type of music, and then they're just kind of cloning themselves. And their new songs aren't as good as their old songs. Now, sometimes you'll find people like Rod Stewart that just reinvents himself, or Linda Ronstadt that would always change her career and then finally go, well, I'm just going to do what I've done. But she's made a solid career. But some people just don't face the fact that maybe what they're doing doesn't have as much energy in it as what their early stuff did.
Oh, I think that's a natural occurrence. I mean, you know, it's like it's just with baseball or whatever else. If you get older, you know, you're going to lose your fastball. David Halberstam, the journalist, wrote a book on Michael Jordan. It's called Playing for Keeps. And one of the things he mentions is that Michael reached a point in his physical development where he knew he wasn't going to be able to play the same style of basketball that he did when he was in his 20s and into his late 20s.
Uh-huh.
And he hired a physical trainer. And what he did was he actually redesigned his body. He did, you know, a whole training program to redesign his body, you know, where he was working on, what he was building up. He went to upper body and he changed his style, he changed his game, and he probably added about easily a good 4 or 5 real good productive years to his career. But that's Michael Jordan.
I know musicians that have done that. They haven't said, well, this is the only thing I do and I'm going to keep doing it. And they ventured off into painting. And Martin Mull's a comedian, musician, that has made more money as a painter than anything he has done. I mean, he was an actor. He's good at all of them, but the gods weren't smiling in the direction to make him an acting superstar. There's other musicians that Kenny Rogers is a fine, fine photographer, as is Bryan Adams, you know. And that's one reason I'm doing radio things. I think my best contributions are still ahead of me. I hope they are. But that's just my opinion.
Well, you know,
and I keep reporting.
Your experience is to a slight degree a mirror image of mine, because, you know, I've been doing journalism, you know, radio, print all my life. And now all of a sudden at 62, I'm actually veering off into music. So just goes to show you.
Uh-huh.
You just don't, you know. Because, you know, I look at the journalism field right now. Journalism, that institution is crumbling all around us. But it's not crumbling. It's changing so radically. It's what it is. It's not.
And syndicated, I believe things like syndicatednews.net, it's kind of like, remember that thing that always was supposed to sell as a teenager, the Grit magazine? Read Grit, or how Boy's Life was so important, and certain little, I think syndicatednews.net is one of the new situations that you can get both audio and print out of it. And it's a neat thing. And yes, change is always in the air. Yeah.
You don't have to be a monster anymore to be successful, to be prosperous. You can find a nice niche, get in there, and, you know, as long as you can keep the ball in the air, you're good.
It's like the book Chris Anderson wrote called The Long Tail. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not, but it's about, because of the internet, it's possible to sell 5 copies a month of something, as well as 10 and maybe 30 on something else, and that it didn't used to make sense to stock something in a store that was only going to do 3 units a month, but now you can because of the internet.
I will say this: when you're talking about the quality of music that's out there these days. Boy, I tell you what, you know, the mainstream outlets, you know, the pop stations, the big stations in town, you know, yeah, I think that's fairly true. It's a little sad, but boy, oh boy, there's a lot of really good music going around that's way under the radar. I don't know if you've heard of any of these singers I'm going to mention, but there's some wonderful singers out named Adele from Britain, Nico Case, Jonathan.
Nico Case. Uh-huh.
You familiar with Nico
Case? I've heard the name, yeah, but yeah. I didn't mean to make that sound like a disparaging comment about the state of the arts. It's partially because with the glut of anybody with $1,500 being able to make an album on GarageBand, there used to be 150 artists and 3 outlets. Now there's 150,000 artists and 500,000 outlets. It's harder to get the word out, and
that's
part of
true.
It. Is dynamic content. And there are plenty of people making great, great records out there.
What cable channel is it? Elvis Costello has a show. Think of the name of it, but Elvis Costello has a show, and he brings guests on. And you can turn, I tuned that in, and all on the same stage, I saw Elvis Costello, Richard Thompson.
They're masters at what they do, and that's an exciting thing to see. Yeah, that's good to know. And yes, you're right. John Fogerty, I think, is better than ever. I saw him in about a year ago. And if anybody liked Creedence, they ought to check him out, because he's, I guess, still relevant in many, many ways. And I think he's better than ever, as I think Pat Mason is. And Pat, I'd like to say thanks for sharing your thoughts on music and the business and all that. And who are you writing about next?
I'm actually contemplating taking my songs to the market. It's something I'm still thinking over before I commit to it. But I'm contemplating doing it because, well, I might. I mean, you know, here's the thing, John. I mean, I have a lot of confidence in my songs, but boy, the marketplace is it's just awful. It just scares me.
Yeah, but there's if they're decent material, and this goes out as advice to anyone that is in your situation, people are often very paranoid about the quality or potential success or the rejection. Keep in mind a few things. Jack London's Call of the Wild was rejected over 600 times before it was printed by a publisher to become a classic American book. And that people that write songs, so often, you've heard the stories, Pat, of many groups, oh, we just threw that song on at the last minute. We needed it to fill up the album. And that's the one that made the big hit. You know, I mean, that's the case of Mr. Bojangles. We told the record company, oh, it's just an album cut. It might get some FM airplay. And they said, that's your first single. We thought our career was over. So, you shouldn't be the judge of your material. And it might hit a nerve in somebody. And get the book called, well, you're a songwriter and you need a guide. There's a book called Songwriter's Guide to Music Publishing by Randy Poe. Songwriter's Guide to Music Publishing by Randy Poe. And that tells that you never know where the songs can go, but you got to give them a chance to live.
Commitment and, you know, what's the word? Dilettantism, if that's a word. And I'm not interested in being a dilettante. I'm just not interested in that, especially at my age. You know, if I do it, I only get one shot because pretty soon I'm going to be on Social Security. and so, you know, if I do it, I want to make sure that it's a combination of deliberate speed, but also I don't want to rush it. Don't want to make any mistakes.
And you don't know that.
Well, let me tell you a really quick story. This is true, and it's not made up or exaggerated. One night I was playing at an open mic, and I played a particular song, and I was heading back to my seat, and a guy was sitting there, and he actually literally tugged on my sleeve. He said, "Man, that song that you just sang, man, that's my life."